Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday, podcast1.com and iTunes. Thank you guys for downloading, streaming, and checking it out wherever you are around the world doing so. It is greatly appreciated. Hope everybody is having a great week. Remember, we got new ones for you every Thursday here on podcast1.com or on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to subscribe and be sure to listen each and every week. As I always tell you guys, the Eddie Trunk Podcast, the interviews you hear in it, originate and come from my Sirius XM radio show, which is heard live daily Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Channel 106 Volume. It's called Trunk Nation. It's nothing but rock talk and interviews, and it replays every night as well, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. It's also on demand on the Sirius XM app. So if you live in the U.S. or Canada, be sure to get on board and join us and listen each and every day, interact, call in, be a part of the show. Here on the podcast, I get to bring you one interview a week or two after it originally airs live here on the show, but it's only a tiny little taste of what I'm doing on a daily basis, so I would appreciate and love if you came on board and joined us and listened on volume each and every day and got involved in the show. Everybody else outside the U.S. and Canada, a good way to give you a little taste of some of the things that I do and do on a daily basis again here in the U.S. So that's what's going on. As we get ready for another huge Eddie Trunk podcast for you this week, which originated and took place at the Rainbow in Los Angeles. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, you know that I go to Southern California once a month and actually do my Sirius XM volume show in front of a live audience from the legendary Rainbow Bar and Grill. The sixth one that I ever did took place on March 19th. And it was with Nikki Sixx and Tommy Lee of Motley Crue the day after the premiere of their movie, The Dirt. I attended the premiere. I attended the post-party for the premiere. And then the next day, Nikki and Tommy, as well as actors from the film, namely Ewan Rayon, who plays Mick Mars, and Douglas Booth, who plays Nikki Sixx, all came and did my show from the Rainbow. Also, at the end of this interview, you'll hear very briefly Tom Zutaut drop by. Tom is the guy who signed Motley Crue. He is featured in the film and portrayed by Pete Davidson. We got him on at the very end. It was a wild one. We had a packed crowd there of people to watch the radio show and see Nikki and Tommy and, of course, the actors. And it was really a great celebration for the movie, which, of course, is now out and posted this past weekend on Netflix. And, you know, getting pretty much what I expected in terms of reviews. I said all along, I think it's one of those deals where if you love Motley Crue, you're going to love the movie. If you never liked Motley Crue or what they were about, you're probably going to hate the movie. And I would think critics would dislike the movie, and that seems to be the case, although, of course, most of the fans love it. And that's exactly how I saw it going. I think one of the interesting things about biopics is people have the need to sort of fact check them, you know, find out what's real and what's not in these movies, how accurate they are. And I understand doing that for fun. But I also think sometimes people kind of get lost a little bit and think these things are documentaries. And nobody is saying they're documentaries. There's obviously going to be liberties taken with these storylines from Hollywood. And if you listen to this interview, I asked Nikki Sixx about that, and he really didn't give much of an answer. He kind of just said, pretty much everything was as is. Although, as we've gone forward, we have found out that there are clearly some rewrites and some storylines injected into the movie. One of the ones that I found out firsthand is that if you've seen the movie, the way Doc McGee is fired, he's fired for bringing Nikki Sixx's mother to meet him. In reality, Doc told me at the party or the post of the premiere, after we left the premiere, I saw him and he told me that he never met Nikki's mother. And if you read the dirt, he actually wasn't fired for that reason. He was fired because he also managed Bon Jovi at the time. And when they did that show in Moscow, Motley Crue felt he was giving favoritism to Bon Jovi, and that was the final straw. So there are going to be those sort of things in all of these biopics, but I don't think it diminishes from the quality of them in any way because they are Hollywood recreations of a story. Look, let's be honest, half of the autobiographies out there are fabricated to some degree. So when you get to this stuff, yeah, you got to just take it for fun. You got to take it for what it is and go for the ride. And, you know, this movie is obviously in the day and times that we're living in now under a different sort of spotlight, but this was what it was like. I lived this in the early 80s. I went to LA. I saw the Sunset Strip. So it's pretty accurate as far as the way the women were, the men were, the scene was, and it's a snapshot of an era and a time that is 30, 40 years ago. So I enjoyed the movie for what it was. I thought it was well done. They had a third of the budget of the Queen movie, so it's hard to compare to the Queen movie because Queen had way more money to work with on that movie, and it was a theatrical release. The only other thing about the movie, too, that's a bit of a bummer for me is the fact that I got to see it as a premiere, which was amazing, in a theater with like 800 people, including the band, and great sound and a huge screen. Because it's a Netflix movie, there's no plans for it to play in theaters. But if that ever changes, it would be great if you guys were able to go see it in a movie theater. But the response is very hot or cold, as I anticipated, and it's drawn very much down the lines of if you're a fan and embrace this period or if you were not a fan. And if you weren't a fan, there's nothing in this movie that's going to change you into being a fan of Motley Crue and that particular era of music and what went on around it. But I had a good time talking to some of the actors. Machine Gun Kelly, who plays Tommy Lee, was supposed to come and be on the show. He canceled at the last minute. Not sure what that was about, but he did not appear. But a little side note, Ewan, who is the guy who plays Mick Mars, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, he plays Ramsay Bolton in Game of Thrones, one of the most evil people ever in TV, if you watch that show. So I do give a quick mention to him about that during the interview as well. So hope you enjoy this. It's probably going to clock in at about an hour and a half. Nikki Sixx is on the entire time. Tommy joins the second half. The actors are there for a good portion of it. Tom Zutaut at the very end. We cover a lot about Motley Crue and what goes on in the dirt, how it was created, what the guys feel like now that it's finally out there. I think you guys will enjoy this conversation. So check it all out as we take you to the rainbow in just a couple minutes from SiriusXM and my latest Trunk Nation LA Invasion from the Rainbow Bar and Grill. Remember, follow me on Twitter at Eddie Trunk, Instagram at Eddie Trunk, Facebook fan page, and also my website, which is eddietrunk.com. Music news updated daily. My appearances on the homepage. You can email me anytime you want. It is all there for you to check out on eddietrunk.com. Signed copies of my second book available if you'd like to order. Merch is available. The Trunk Report, which is my blog. And if you follow on any of the social media outlets, please make it Twitter, where I'm most active and up to the second. As a matter of fact, the next Trunk Nation LA invasion is really close to happening again. I'll be announcing details about that very, very soon, if not already. So if you're in Southern California, come out and join us for these rainbow remotes. So much fun, and they're totally free to get into, and we have a real good time there. All right, let's take a little break here. We'll come right back and go to the rainbow for Motley Crue and my radio special being brought to you this week on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Coming up.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out. And you guys can look at over together. You can ask questions. You get the answers you need, so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trading your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
Podcast One's coverage of March Madness runs on diesel.
All right, it's March, which means it's time for the madness. So you know we got it all covered on the big podcast with me, Shaq. The legendary, get him out the game, baby! Dick Vitale, how you doing, coach?
Hey, Shaq, what's going on, man?
And we're way more than just sports, Shaquille. So be prepared to laugh as we bring you the best basketball coverage.
The big podcast with Shaq. Check us out with new episodes every Monday at podcastone.com.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Eddie Trunk here, and this is the Eddie Trunk Podcast on podcastone.com and iTunes. And as I mentioned, my latest LA invasion, that's what we call them when I do my monthly specials from the Rainbow in Los Angeles. The latest one took place a couple weeks ago with Nikki Sixx and Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, not even 2 weeks ago, plus actors from The Dirt. I think you're going to really love this conversation, especially coming off of the fact that The Dirt is now out there and everybody has had a chance to see it on Netflix and make their own opinions and judgments about it, which there seems to be many. So with that said, here we go with a live audience from the legendary Rainbow Bar and Grill. This is the Trunk Nation LA Invasion now being able to be brought to you via the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Enjoy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Nikki Sixx, everybody. And Mr. Douglas Booth, who plays Nikki in the film. And Ewan Rayan, who plays Mick Mars in the film as well, is on his way up here. And they are making their way out of the Rainbow. I think they probably were just having some really good pizza back there. And they didn't want to walk away from their pizza. Good to see you, man. Nikki Sixx, everybody! And the man who plays Nikki Sixx, Mr. Douglas Booth. And the man who plays Mick Mars in the film, Ewan, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming. Yeah. Guys, get some headphones on, and we will get into this. Looking forward to talking about anybody here in the audience, were you guys at the premiere last night? Yeah. So you guys saw it, right?
I saw it. It was amazing.
Pretty amazing. Nikki, for you, man, this has got to feel like, finally.
I'm just worried about my hair.
It looks beautiful. Okay. Yeah, it looks beautiful. This has got to be like all the years and all the work and all the stop starts with this thing. How does it feel to finally be days away from everybody seeing it?
It was we've seen it a lot, you know, during the shooting and the edits and stuff like that. And I've seen it, I think, twice at Netflix, seeing it on the big screen. But it was really different than sitting there with just, you know, a couple of the actors and director and producers and stuff, and then seeing it with, what, how many people were there? 800? 800 people, yeah. And the worst part was, like, sitting next to my 18-year-old daughter.
Oh, boy.
I had some explaining to do after that.
I'm sure. But it was amazing seeing, you know, I had seen it. You had sent me a link a few weeks ago, and I watched it on my laptop. But to be able to watch it in a theater,
yeah,
audio cranked up on the big screen, was a truly incredible experience. And the guy sitting next to you, Douglas Booth, forever to be known as Nikki Sixx, as the guy who played Nikki Sixx.
Well, I have to say also, during the conversation last night, thanks, Douglas, my daughter's like, he's really cute. I go, that's dark because you're talking about me at the same time. It's right. It's messed up, right? So thanks for that.
I look very different right now than I do when I'm in the film. So.
Yeah, well, I think she prefers the way you look now.
All right.
In the version of me, yeah.
What was it, Nikki, for you, before we get to these guys and their amazing performances and just and talk about the film, there was so much that went on from getting this from a book to the movie that's finally coming out. Did you ever doubt that this day would happen? Were you ever wondering if you'd ever get this thing finally made?
Yeah, when it was at Paramount, I was starting to feel that it was maybe not going to get made because they had the rights to it. Tom Freston, who was at MTV, and MTV, Viacom company, Paramount, you know, they're all in line with each other. So it was optioned by Paramount, and then Tom left. And so we were at Paramount, and during time when there's a lot of turnovers, so there wasn't, we didn't really have somebody cheering for the movie. It was now, had gone to corporate. And I will say the thing about Paramount is I believe they did have the foresight to believe that a rock biopic would be important because obviously they did the Queen movie, and I think the Rocket Man, the Elton John movie, is with them as well. But they wanted to do something that wouldn't have worked for this movie, which was to clean it up. And I think that the warts are part of the beauty, and it's part of the lesson in the movie. And if we would have taken that out, we would have taken the car crashes out and the drug overdoses and the personal issues that we each had collectively and individually. I don't know. It just wasn't right for us. It's right for Queen because they had just one issue to deal with Freddie. They didn't have multiple issues.
Well, you mentioned the Queen movie, and I think that's interesting because this was something that was talked about being a movie, I think, if I'm not mistaken, long before anybody even heard about the Queen biopic.
Yeah.
But of course, the Queen movie got out ahead of this a little bit and went on to have this phenomenal success. I mean,
yeah,
the biggest biopic in history,
yeah,
at this point.
I think it's almost grossed $1 billion.
It's
like
crazy.
Aladdin.
It's the highest grossing drama ever as well.
Really?
I think so.
Jesus.
But when you saw that happen,
yeah,
and what was going on with Queen, how did anything come in your mind about this? Did you say to yourself, well, that's good because it's a good table setter, people are going to be hungry for more of this? Or did you say, oh, shit, we got to have to find a – are we going to kind of live up to people's expectations seeing that movie?
No, I mean, we were super happy. And if anything, it raised awareness about rock music globally beyond rock fans. You know, it went into the mainstream. And I think that that's what we all want, is to take the music that we love and get beyond just the base of our fans, which is fantastic. But a lot of people here at one point were not fans of rock music. You were listening to something else and you discovered your bands. And I'm hoping that from this movie that there's a lot of young people that discover rock music. I mean, Motley Crue, obviously, but Elton John and Queen as well. Hopefully it doesn't become like one of those VH1 behind the the, what was it,
music
called? Yeah. I mean, meaning that every single person has one, you know.
Right.
So I think they're very special, and it takes a special band, special actors and producers and directors to make something like this. Because rock movies can be a little bit, like, you know, the movie Rockstar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little cheesy.
Yeah. No, this is anything but. This is a phenomenal movie. I don't think, as I've said, everybody's asked me about it who knows I've seen it. And I said, if you love Motley Crue and you love a great rock and roll story, there's absolutely nothing you're not going to love about the film. The last thing about the creation of it and getting to this point before we talk to get beyond this, what was the single biggest challenge
Nikki, in getting this thing made across the board? Was it the casting? Was it the script? Was it the director? Was it the studio? What was the biggest hurdle that you had?
We had a lot of directors that showed up, and some wanted to make a kind of a mid-'80s fluff piece. One guy thought it would be more fun, you know, kind of a fun movie. And that was a real issue for us. And when Jeff Tremaine, his name came up, we were like, we didn't understand how that would work. Because, again, coming from the Jackass world, that's more of a comedy type, you know, movie and TV shows.
Some of those guys were there last night. I thought they were going to kick into a skit or something.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Steve-O was there, and all those guys were in the audience. Yeah.
That's cool. So, you know, once Jeff showed up, and Netflix became interested, all the pieces started to come into place. How long before you guys had been being contacted as far as casting?
How long was that?
How long ago? Yeah, before we started shooting.
I was like 2013 or something. I was attached for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
You were Nikki Six for like 6 years before anybody knew you were Nikki Six.
No, I was almost Tommy Lee for a second.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was almost Tommy Lee, and then they went, we can't find someone to play Nikki's because he's such a he's a very complex character. And he's it's true.
Needed a very special actor.
Eventually I made a tape for Nikki, and the rest is history.
So Douglas, were you obviously it sounds like you're British, right? You grew up
I
in
am,
England.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you grow up a Motley Crue fan? Were you a Motley Crue fan?
Well, I was very aware of them because they were so ingrained in like 80s rock culture. But I was born in 92, so.
Son of a bitch. you bastard.
I'd heard them, but then I really, really fell in love with them making this movie.
I liked that some of the actors weren't 100% ingrained in Motley Crue's story because it gave you guys a fresh perspective as actors.
Yeah.
And that's something that was important to the band is to let the actors take on the role. We didn't want to micromanage it to death, and we definitely didn't want to micromanage it to the point where we're whitewashing it and trying to clean it up and try to save our asses. Wanted to really hand it over to Jeff, and Jeff was going to direct these guys with the producers to make the right film.
Ewan, what about you? You play Mick Mars in the film. First of all, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this is one of the most evil men on the planet if you're a Game of Thrones fan right there. Ramsay there on the end, who is now unfortunately dead from that film or that series. So now you're playing Mick Mars. But tell me about how this role came to you and when you were first approached about it.
I think, first of all, I met with Jeff in L.A. in his office, I think it was about 2 years ago. And, yeah, we talked about the film. But it was more kind of like just generally meeting him and having a chat and stuff. And then, then they asked me to do a tape for Mick. So I did. I put some eyeliner on and did a tape, and luckily I got the part. It was about 2 years ago.
And did you get to spend some time with Mick? I mean, were you a big Motley Crue fan, first of all?
No, very much like Douglas. I was, you know, really aware of the band, but not necessarily a huge fan. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously subsequently fallen in love with those tunes.
But you play some guitar, too.
Yeah.
You actually play?
In real.
Yeah. You do.
Yeah. Slightly, no, I mean, I'm nowhere near as good as Mick, but
I heard you shredding in New Orleans. it was good.
Yeah, it was quite challenging to play that stuff, man. It's
better than the bass player.
well, Douglas, do you play bass?
No, I learned for this.
You did?
Yeah.
Did you get lessons from Nicky?
Yeah, he was so generous and he was so generous. He would text me and be like, try this bass riff and do this. Like I'd get like personal coaching from Nikki Six, which is pretty cool.
So do either of you have an interest in playing now? Like really getting into playing some?
Well, guitar.
Yeah, guitar or bass.
I mean, I've played guitar all my life.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. So it's slightly sort of more, not quite as heavy, but it was really good fun getting to put the distortion pedal on and make a lot of noise and piss off my neighbors. Like,
Ewan, let me ask you, this is something that just came to me, too, because of the four members of Motley Crue, such huge personalities, so much is known about all of them and all the different things in the book and what have you. But Mick is a guy that, if there is such a thing as being under the radar in Motley Crue in terms of all the stuff that's gone on with the band, you know, maybe the least is known, maybe the, sort of like the least big personality, if you will, of the four guys in the band. So how did you go about learning his character and learning him and getting a feel for how to play him?
I think, well, first of all, in the book itself, I think that there was so much in there that I could take of Mick, and you sort of hear him speaking it, and but there's not that much sort of footage of him or interviews or anything like that. It's quite rare.
Right.
So you had to sort of, I had to sort of try and search and find some little bits so I could listen to him talking. And of course, a big thing is the sort of physicality, which is really important for Mick.
With because of his condition,
spondylitis. So, but also I didn't want to kind of over-egg it and make it too, you know, all about that, because he's, you know, there's a lot more to it than that. So yeah, that was kind of a challenge for me. But yeah, that's where I kind of...
Did you get to spend time with him?
No, no, we spoke on the phone.
Okay.
He made this t-shirt for you then.
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
what's
amazing.
It say? Touch me?
Touch me, I'll kill you. It's, it's a replica of one that he used to wear a lot, he said. And, yes, and he his wife made it and sent it to me. So I wore it in the film a couple of times.
Yeah.
Had to get it in, yeah.
I love the scene at the pool when you're... as Mick, sitting underneath the umbrella, and Ozzy calls the band out.
Oh, the best scene.
A great scene. But I love the way that you showed that Mick was in pain, but you didn't overdo it. Like, I saw it. I just saw you just kind of...
Totally.
Take a second. That was it. It was just enough. I always wanted to tell you that. It just was really perfectly handled.
Thank you very much.
Because he wasn't, like... You know, Mick now is, what's the word? It's stopped progressing, basically. So he is.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So he is where he is, and he's told me multiple times he's glad that the way that his spine fused slightly forward, he can see his guitar neck, because that's all he really cares about is guitar. And it's so people think it is bad. He does deal with pain. But it's not so dramatic, and I love that you didn't make it that way.
Yeah, I think that was really important, because he's overcome it, and you know he's not let it get in his way, and I think that's one of the great, you know, one of the most amazing things about him. So that was very important to sort of do it, but not overdo it.
And Nicky, that's exactly right. I picked up on that too when I saw it on big screen last night, because you just get up almost like there's a pinch and you're like, but it's not over the top. Just to remind people, if you're watching closely, that yeah, this guy's dealing with something. And yeah. I really thought that was amazing as well. So it sounds like though, Douglas, you and Nicky spent some time together. I mean, did you guys, are you based here now, Douglas, in Los Angeles?
I'm living here temporarily, but I'm based in London.
You didn't tell me that.
did you not know that?
I didn't know that. Oh, we're fighting.
Yeah. So did you guys...
He moves to L.A. from the U.K. and doesn't tell me.
I know. We've got to hang out more.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't want to now.
So you guys spent a lot of time together. Like, Nicky, that's got to be somewhat of a... Like, how do you tell somebody, here's how to be like me? I mean, like, you just hang around with them?
He was always so generous and inviting and kind, and made me feel so safe. Because I remember when I went to first meet him, I was like, no, you read The Dirt and you're like, oh my God, I'm about to meet Nicky Six. He walked through the door and he was just the most generous, warm, kind, inviting person. Made me feel so safe to play him. And you kind of gave me a copy of The Heroin Diaries, which I hadn't read at that point, which really helped in my research. And yeah, you always made me feel very welcome and made it very easy for me.
Thank you.
And Nicky, what's it like for you to watch a movie and watch a guy playing you? Like, when you watch him and you watch him dressed as you and acting like you as best as he can and performing as you. I mean, are you looking at a mirror, or like, how does that impact? Like, I can't imagine what that would be like from your perspective.
I was trying to figure out how to put it into words, and Vince actually said it to me the other day on the phone. He said after like a couple minutes of watching the film, I forgot he was watching a film about us, and I felt the same way. I couldn't put my finger on it. I just got sucked into the movie, and then there'll be little moments. It's like really hard for me to even think about. And talk about, but when I was strung out on heroin and my mom was calling, and I actually didn't have, I think, the courage or the I wasn't mature enough to pick up the phone to confront my mom or to have closure. And that scene when you're shooting up and the phone's ringing and she's calling, it's really hard to watch. But that's the stuff I like about that. That will, I'll be like, oh shit, that's real. And then I get lost back in the movie.
It's amazing, and everybody's going to have a chance to see this this film on Friday when it posts on Netflix around the world. The anticipation is off the charts, and you got to be feeling it from the fans, I think, at this point, right, Nikki, that this thing is finally imminent. Like, they never thought they were going to see this day come, and it's almost here.
It's really cool. I mean, I think we all got a lot of feedback from the premiere.
Yeah.
From fans, seeing online what people are saying online. Not the press so much, like actual fans.
Yeah.
We're both rock fans.
Right.
Big time rock fans. And we could talk about UFO for 8 hours.
Which there was a poster in the movie.
Yes,
there
was.
The greatest
yes.
thing. As soon as it came out, I was like, yes, there's a UFO poster yes. in a movie.
Yes. Absolutely.
These two are looking at us like, these two old guys talking about UFO.
It's a great band name.
And you're both British, aren't you?
Yeah.
You better know
yeah.
UFO, for God. It's a British band. Nikki and I are going to take the next hour and a half. Is just
it was a long, long time ago.
UFO, yeah.
There was a guy named Michael Schenker that people still trying to play like. Yeah.
And a guy named Pete Way, where Nikki had some pants like Pete at one
That's
point.
That's right, I sure
yeah.
did.
Yeah, yeah. absolutely. But yeah, it is an homage as well to just a great era for rock music, the movie. That's a great point, by the way. It's like, when I'm watching this thing, and look, I know that everybody knows you guys did a lot of fucked up stuff. Let's be honest. Everybody knows that. That's no secret. But there is also something when you watch the movie that, and maybe it's just because of my age and we're around the same age, that you look at that and you're like, those were kind of the good old days. You know, when you see where we're sitting right now, the Rainbow and the Strip and what went on and the flyering and the whiskey and the vibe and, you know, destroying hotel rooms and everything. Of course it's not right, but there's an element as a rock fan that you're like, damn, that was the shit back then, you know? And I don't know, maybe it's just sort of a romantic thing, but I don't know if that conjured that up for you or not, but I'm like, we need some bands throwing shit out of windows again onto people's cars, you know?
Yeah, bands now do yoga before they go on stage. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I've heard. Mostly the British bands do yoga.
I've been backstage at more shows now where they're juicing, and yes, they're getting their yoga lessons.
Colonics.
Exactly. So there is something about that. Did those things bring back a lot of fond memories? Just sitting here, Nikki, you're in the Rainbow. We're at the Rainbow right now. So there's a couple scenes in the movie at the Rainbow.
Yeah.
I mean, did it bring back a lot of great memories for you, I imagine?
Some of that stuff, and it's a lot of people have asked us over the years, what was the Sunset Music Strip scene like? And we've always been saying we actually don't know, because we you know, I was playing in the late 70s here in Los Angeles in my band London, and that was right kind of like the punk thing, new wave thing was happening, and I wanted to differentiate a band from that scene, and that's where the first Motley Crue album came from. I was writing a lot of that music, which was for the other band. And I had a conversation with the band that we needed to compete. We needed to get heavier. We needed to compete with the punks, to be honest with you. And we disagreed, so I quit the band. The greatest decision I ever made was to leave one of the biggest bands in Los Angeles at that time. And I didn't have a backup plan. I didn't have a job. Luckily, I had a girlfriend, so I had somewhere to live. And I was writing these songs. And that's I met Tommy and, you know, the history of how the band got together. And what I love is that the movie really represents that part of Motley Crue. Like, you got to understand who Tommy was. He was living at home with his mom and dad. You got to understand how I came to Los Angeles. You understood that 10 years before we even met Mick, he had been diagnosed, and Vince as well. So that was important to me before we got to the Rainbow, before any of that stuff started happening.
Well, there's a scene in the movie where you had just quit London, and Tommy Coulson, who plays Tommy, of course, yeah. walks up to you at what I think is Dupar's. It's supposed to be Dupar's, it looks like, because
yeah.
I saw it on the window. And he pulls up right at, you know, flipping his sticks right at the booth and starts talking to you. And you were even though in the film you're kind of giving him a little bit of the once over, you're kind of receptive in letting him, this stranger, kind of sit down and twirl his sticks and talk to you. Is that really how it happened? Did you immediately have some sort of vibe with him that you were welcoming like that initially?
Yeah, there was absolutely darkness and lightness, and we were drawn to each other because of that. I would come up with the idea how to get the TV out the window, and then Tommy would throw the TV out the window. We worked well together, but my hands were clean.
You were the you pulled the strings, and you dispatched someone else to do the do the work.
No, but that was always our relationship, was this darkness and lightness. His his personality is very outgoing, and he loves everything. He's quick to fall in love with stuff. And, we just see things differently. And that's part of the magic. Even in our musicianship, Tommy plays more fills, like grooves inside the groove, all this stuff. And I'd like to play it straight right down the middle, just like AC/DC or like the Pistols. I don't do a lot of walking. It's just not... I don't believe that I'm serving the song, and as a songwriter, I'm thinking, what should the bass be doing to the song? And that's usually to just hold down the fort.
And in that early period of the band's history, which again is chronicled in the film, there's a great moment in it where there's a different guitar player in the band, and then Mick, you and your character, Mick, comes in for the audition, and you basically... immediately, right out of the gate, they're calling you the old guy, which did you, was that really like right out of the gate you were busting balls like that, Nikki, with Mick?
A bit. I mean, it was really Mick who kind of would call Tommy a teenager, which,
or just call him drummer, right?
Drummer, teenager, whatever. And I love that. You nailed Mick. Oh yeah. What was, you really did explain the fact that there's very little out there about Mick. I mean, yes, if you're a diehard Motley Crue fan, but you can find anything on the other guys,
right,
and do research. And where Mick really is, his strong suit is his one-liners. And we literally, he will say nothing for a day, and then he'll say one thing, and we're like, whoa.
Well, that's almost like when you dismiss the other guitar player. Yeah. In the, there's a great moment in there. I forget the exact line or something, but where they're trying to, Nikki, I think I'm talking to Nikki like he's Douglas when I should be talking. It's just very confusing for me. But Douglas, where you turn to Ewan and say, well, go ahead and take care of it, and Mick's character does the hatchet job on the other guy in there, and that just captured the way, with very few words, Mick can get what he needs to get done, right? I mean, that was really his whole demeanor.
Yeah, I think I remember you telling me that about Mick, how he wouldn't say anything, and then he'll just have that one killer line. And I think the script was written very well like that. He just very sparingly had his little moments. But I think what's interesting about him is almost like it's the audience's way into the movie, to gauge what these guys are doing through Mick's reactions to just how everything's going. So that, I think, is part of the dynamics, a really crucial part of the dynamic of the band. I would imagine when you guys were
nailed it.
And was there was another guitar player at that at that point? Was there ever a consideration that Motley would be a two guitar band, Nikki?
Yeah, there was always the intention.
Yeah.
But Mick didn't. He said there's only one guitar player. Right. I mean, I wanted us to be like an Aerosmith or a Stones. All my song ideas I always have two guitar part ideas, but that never happened.
And then when you guys go and begin your search for the singer, and you go to that party that Vince is playing in his band Rock Candy, again, being the music geek that I am, I look at every single little thing and take it all in. I watch every credit till the very end. But he's playing a great Billy Squier song, My Kind of Lover, in the movie. Was he actually playing that? Do you actually recall that song?
Doing that song. I remember him playing He's a Whore by Cheap Trick.
That's another great song.
Which, Too Fast for Love, the verse is basically He's a Whore.
Right, right.
And... I mean, it is the verse. I mean, it is Cheap Trick.
Rick is there Nielsen, a statue get Rick of Nielsen. Limitation? I don't know. I was just going to say.
I don't know. No, it's not Cheap Trick. It's not Cheap Trick.
It's been 30 years, so I think you're good. Okay, at least 30 years.
Trick. It is Cheap Trick.
Rick, Nicky just ripped you off, he's telling you, so he'll send you the check. Do you guys, I mean, I know you're in the movie, you were all just at the premiere and everything, but when Friday comes, will you, like, get some friends together and watch it, or do you, when you're done with something, you just move on?
I mean, I've seen it three times now.
You're done with it.
So, no, I'm definitely not done with it. It's actually it's my favorite film to watch that I've ever made. It is so fun, and you get so, I kind of forget that I'm in it, and I just get swept along for the ride.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have a lot of friends who are doing viewing parties. I think my mate's got a bar, and he's going to project on a big screen and you know, have a lock in and have some fun.
Ewan, what about for you? Are you gonna watch?
I'm going to, where's this party? I'll see you there.
He's looking for the party.
You can come to my house. The Douglas can't come. No, you can't come. We're fighting now.
Nicky, you talked about your daughter who was at the premiere.
Yeah.
And for your kids watching it, how do you handle that? Just, hey, that's how Daddy was at the time, or.
My kids are smart. They get it. I've done a couple things I think were important in their life. One is that if you go to my house, there's no gold or platinum records anywhere. They're in boxes in storage. And that doesn't mean I don't love them. I just don't need them to define who I am. And for my kids to be defined by a dad who has 50 gold and platinum records when they're, you know, I'd bring their friends over. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So my kids grew up with a dad that wanted to be everything my dad wasn't. I wanted to be present. I made the bologna sandwiches. I took them to school. You know, I'd stay late in the studio. I'd get up early. You know, it wasn't easy, but I did it. And I raised my kids mostly in divorce. And that was hard. And, you know, obviously I'd been through that. So there was a lot of triggers for me where I wanted to be present for my kids. They've heard stories. I've told them stuff. And can you imagine having me sit down with you if you're a kid to have the drug talk? Oh my God. And I like to make up shit and it's not even real and then it becomes real. So I had a thing called the talking chair in my house, and that was in my bedroom, and it was this like zebra striped antique chair. And if you got called to the talking chair, it was like, oh, no, because Dad can talk, man, and he can talk. And that's what we would talk about, like real issues and real stuff. So by the time they came to the, you know, they see the movie, they knew that Dad had been a drug addict and had survived that and was in recovery. And but there's stuff they met, I guess, their grandmother, my mom, a few times. And it was hard for them because they saw that we had nothing, and they were trying to, like, I took them to Seattle to be with my mom, and they couldn't feel a connection to her either. So it was like weird for them. And then they saw what happened to me that I never explained to them about the knife, being a kid. Mm-hmm. And, they put me in the talking chair after that, I guess. But yeah, it's real stuff, you know, and you gotta address it, and it's cool to be a rock star and all that stuff, but it's more important for me to be a human being.
You know, there's something that connected with me in the film also is when you change your name, and you did it pretty quickly, and you went. First of all, how did you come up with Nicky Six from Frank Ferrana? What was that process?
So I was in the band London.
Yeah,
and I had changed my name to Nicky. I was Nicky London from London because all my favorite bands were from London, and I wasn't a big thinker. And I actually figured out how to get this guy Nigel Benjamin, who replaced Ian Hunter in Mott the Hoople, that became Mott, and then the British Lions, to come to L.A. and be the singer in London, and he was British. So everything was working great. I had these dreams. My uncle was the president of Capitol Records. So I'm like, this is it. I'm going to do this. And I figured I didn't want to be Nicky London of London. I don't know why that kept coming to my head. So I was going to change my name to Nicky Nine. But there was this girl that I was – we were sharing a bed together. And she had a boyfriend named Nicky Six. So I said, not only am I going to steal his girlfriend, I'm going to steal his name. And it was a joke. that turned out pretty cool. Isn't that weird?
That is weird.
Well, weird. Can you cuss on this channel?
Yeah.
What a weird fucking life.
And you know what I never put together until I watched the movie was on with the show, Frankie died the other night. That's
how you knew that.
I never put that together until last night because I, even knowing.
Did you guys know that? Understand that? Did you understand why that song was there? Okay, so I changed my name, obviously, but the song On With The Show, the open, it was on our first album. It says Frankie died just the other night. Some say it was suicide. So I metaphorically killed myself to rid myself of my father, and I changed my name. And that's how that came. Interesting to get flipped back to the kids coming here. My daughter, Frankie, called me. Wow, life's weird, man.
You know, it'd be really weird if you change your name to Douglas Booth.
Oh, you change yours to Frank. Yeah. But she called me and said to me, I realize now why you named me that, which was to have closure with your father.
Mm. Yeah.
See, we thought we were going to have fun. You brought me in here. I'm a little dark rain cloud.
All right. No, let's talk about getting blowjobs under the booth in the rainbow then. Let's turn it around and have some fun.
There you go.
Is that girl still in there, Nikki? Do we know if she's still in there? That's a prominent scene in the film with a couple of, well, Razzle, when he sits down, who welcomes it, and Tom, the character of Tom Zutaut, who's played by Pete Davidson,
yeah,
who sits down and jumps away from it. Yeah. But talk a little bit, if you will, about your connection to the place we're appropriately doing this in right now, the Rainbow here in Los Angeles. When did you first come here?
I came here in late 70s, 76, 77.
To this, at the Rainbow.
So I was 20 in 78. So Mario and they would. I was a good fast talker, and I'd get myself in here somehow. And then
was it tough to get in at that time?
You know, I don't know. I don't want to throw them under the bus, but yes, super easy to get in.
Oh, easy to
so
get in.
So you get in. It was the cool place. There was lots of musicians. First time I heard about the Rainbow, I was at a friend's house in the Valley. So it had to be maybe 1976. I was like maybe 17 years old, and his older brother came home. And we were listening to his stereo, the older brother's stereo in his bedroom, right, listening to UFO or something. And he came in, he said, I saw Robert Plant. And we're like, where the fuck did you see Robert Plant? And he goes, and I saw Mick Jagger. I go, where is this place?
Mythical rock and roll heaven, yeah.
Yeah, and he goes, it's called the Rainbow, and we took a bus to get here. I didn't get in then, but that was the first time coming here. And that's what I thought was going on inside there. So we had to get in. Ironically, later when I was 22, when the band started, Tommy was 17 or 18, we had to sneak Tommy in the way I used to get snuck in.
Underage?
Yeah.
Because you guys were underage.
Yeah. Well, Tommy was underage when the band started.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, obviously, if the walls could talk in this place, but a little bit of what went on back then is in the film. Now, was that actually shot here, or was that shot where did you actually shoot the stuff from the Rainbow?
So we actually shot the film in New Orleans.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they built a replica of the Rainbow, the whiskey, and yeah.
Wow. So everything that in the film was shot in New Orleans,
huh? Well, they did like exterior stuff here and, you know, made the world feel real and. But the rest of the movie was shot in New Orleans.
Yeah. That probably didn't suck, though, to spend that much time in New Orleans, right?
We arrived.
Yeah, we had some fun. Yeah.
I've heard stories about you guys. You guys were going out, weren't you?
Yeah, not as hard as you guys did back in the day. But
I heard stories. I heard you bit Jeff Tremaine.
Did I? Well, I remember this was the first night we went out, and I read that in the book, The Dirt, you... You went around. Who was it that you famously bit? Was it the guy from?
We bit Eddie Van Halen's hand.
Yeah, and I think we were watching Big Frieda, and I think I was just getting carried away and a bit drunk, and like jokingly bit Jeff, trying to be as cool as you, but not succeeding.
Jeff deserves to be bitten.
Yeah, he does,
doesn't he?
He's very biteable.
You got caught up in being Nikki Sixx, didn't you? Didn't you, Douglas?
Exactly. I mean, it's quite a yeah. Yeah, it's seductive.
Life imitating art? Is that what, that's what they usually say about that, right? Ewan, for you, did you enjoy the process of actually... tell me if I'm wrong here, but watching this thing, it looks to me like if I was an actor in it, it would have been a blast to make. It would have been so much fun. Was it fun, the whole shoot?
Yes. it was really good fun. You know, from we got to spend a lot of time together in New Orleans before we started shooting, which is quite rare. And we had the thing which was called band camp. It's not as cool. It was a lot cooler than it sounds. And where we would just sort of learn the songs and we all sort of got to know each other and we had a lot of time.
And that's rare on a movie to get that much time together before you start.
So was that where me and Tommy went?
Yeah, you came.
That was fantastic.
And we there was Mardi Gras. So we all sort of hung out a lot. So we became really good friends very early on. And I think that comes across in the movie, the dynamic of the group. And then, yeah, so it was a lot of fun. And Jeff likes to keep a loose set. It's not, you know, he's playing music in between takes and stuff, which, you know, is very rare. And also he gave us a lot of freedom with the characters as well and with the lines and saying, what would you say, do you think, if you want to add a lot of improvising going on, which is quite rare, but, you know, still very focused. We all had to be very focused because you just have to be on a film set. But, yeah, we had a lot of freedom, so it was a lot of fun, yeah.
Nikki, how often did you get to New Orleans to check on what was going on?
We went one time.
We went for
a few days, hung out there, yeah.
And Jeff, who for everyone who hasn't figured it out, Jeff is Jeff Tremaine, who directed it. And that in and of itself was, it sounds like a savior in making this movie happen. Why was that the right guy to you, Nikki?
Jeff, Alan Kovac, Motley Crue's manager and one of the co-producers on the film, called me and mentioned Jeff Tremaine, and I love Jackass stuff, but I didn't get it because we were very scared of having a movie be made about our band that would destroy what we had built. You know, it's pretty normal for an artist to be concerned about something like that, and there's been not a lot of rock movies out there that we felt we could tip our hat towards and go. There's like a lot of good experiences there. Now we got the Queen movie now, but before that you had the Doors movie. Mm-hmm. Almost Famous is awesome, but it's not a real band.
Right.
So there, Cameron Crowe had a lot of wiggle room to make that story however you wanted to make it. So we were a little scared of Jeff because we didn't want to make a comedy. Yet there's fun bits about it. You know, a lot of fun.
Right.
He sat down with me in New York, and he convinced me. He was like, I'm the guy, and he told me why. And he had this sizzle reel that just kind of blew my mind. And he thought I was going to say no, and I said yes. And he thought Tommy was going to be an easy sell, and Tommy was a really hard sell.
Really?
Yeah, Tommy was like really put him through the ringer.
And you were worried it was going to kind of be goofy or corny and just not.
Yeah.
Because the thing about this film is that for all the fun moments in it, and there are some literally laugh-out-loud moments, there's some heavy drama in this movie, too. I mean, that's the story of Motley Crue, and that needs to come across to really tell this the right way, and it does.
Yeah, I think it's some really, really emotional bits. I mean, watching it last night, I was getting a bit teary at some of it, you know, and it's got a lot, you know, obviously it's all the fun bit and all the rock and roll, but it's also got that real sort of dramatic element.
The girl who plays Vince's daughter is one of the best actresses I've ever
really?
Seen. She's
wonderful,
like, like 5 years old or something. And I'm like,
did she really cry? Was that real
tears?
Yeah,
she's incredible. Like, she's incredible.
I was like looking at that. I was like, they must have put something in her eyes.
No.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
How old is she? She's probably like.
I'm not sure how.
Yeah, she can't be more than six.
Yeah, she got. She probably got like eight agents last night.
Right? Was she at the premiere, Douglas? She was.
No,
there.
I didn't see her. There's so many people there, but
I don't think the opening scene would be good for her.
Yeah. No,
she actually definitely wasn't there. Obviously, she wasn't.
Probably,
there.
Yeah, no,
when that opening scene, when that opening scene happened,
explain the opening scene.
I'm not going to explain the opening scene.
Come on, Nikki.
So it was like this moment in the theater, and I just heard this, and it was just like everybody exhaled, and I was like, okay, start breathing.
start breathing.
Should we not explain the opening scene? Should we let people wait till Friday?
Well, it's the opening of the book as well, and I think like it's the one thing I read online the most. Like, is it going to open the same
very
way?
Very important
the book,
to people.
It, a lot of there. People. It's very important that it is.
Let's just say it's the squirter. Yeah. Shall we leave it at that?
We'll be right back with more with Nikki, Tommy, cast members of The Dirt from the Rainbow in L.A. on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, if you like my show, you're going to love the Jordan Harbinger Show on Podcast One. Join the host of one of the most downloaded new podcasts of 2018 as he dissects the game plans of the most successful people on the planet in order to help you be the best you can be. Check out the Jordan Harbinger Show every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Let's get back to more of my conversation with members of Motley Crue about The Dirt from the Rainbow in L.A. on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast.
We are here celebrating the release of The Dirt coming on Netflix this Friday. Also, new music from Motley Crue with a soundtrack we'll talk about in a second. And we are going to now welcome Ewan stays with us, Douglas stays with us, Nikki stays with us. And now we are going to welcome the drummer in Motley Crue. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for Tommy Lee, everybody.
What's up?
I have a hat very similar to Tommy's hat, and thank God I follow him on Instagram, even though he blocked me at one point in my life, because I saw what hat he was wearing, and I didn't wear mine, because we would really be...
It would be so gay.
Tommy,
Tommy,
you were at the post party last night. I saw you briefly at the whiskey.
Of course.
Did you just roll up from there? Did you were you there still? Did you just never go home?
I think I slept for maybe a couple hours.
In your car?
Have you ever left the Rainbow since the early scenes in the movie? You've been back there at that booth the whole time, haven't you?
You know what's crazy? I just walked down the stairs, and I just started to walk.
You did the loop?
I didn't know where the
loop.
I did the loop. I did a lap. I didn't know where the interview was, actually. Yeah. So I walked like right to where we always sat. They're like,
you were waiting for me?
Yeah, they're like, no, dude. It's outside. I'm like, oh, okay. So this is where B-Real smokes a shitload of joints.
So do you remember, like, if you were, like, starting to make some noise here in Los Angeles, you would eventually get to the back corner booth. That's what Tommy's probably talking about in the back.
Yep.
That was the booth.
Or
the prime spot.
Or the one in the middle.
Or the stairs up to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Oh, that booth, the long one along the side there as people go in up and down the stairs.
Yeah, you go up the stairs and then you go left.
Oh, up the annex up top.
Yeah, no. Yeah, the bathroom.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
I guess you can call it the annex. You can call it whatever.
You can call it whatever you want. You can call it anal.
When was the last time either of you guys were here at the Rainbow? I mean, it's probably quite difficult for you to come here and just order a pizza with so many fans here. But are you able to come in here and kind of low key it and hang out every once in a while?
We both live really far from here, actually.
Oh, you do.
Yeah, so, but it's kind of a beast to come down.
Yeah, but come here a lot. A lot of friends play at the Roxy next door.
Right.
So I've been here. I don't know. Not that long ago, a couple times. Who did I see? By the way, the Foo Fighters, love the fucking movie.
Oh,
Taylor
hit me up last night.
Yeah,
freaking
dude,
out.
He was. Yeah, I was on the phone with him for like 20 minutes. He's like, "Dude, the fucking movie's fucking rad. This is fucking crazy." Yeah.
I saw him in the lobby afterwards. We talked about it. He's pretty amped up.
He was flipping out.
Yeah.
So rad.
Tommy, what do you think of the movie, man? I mean, I mean, you weren't here in the first hour, but I talked to Nikki a lot about it and how it's taken so long to get to this point. Now you've seen it on the big screen last night. How are you feeling about this thing?
It's epic.
You're happy with everything.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And I tell people, Nikki and I saw the movie at my home. We were recording new music for The Dirt, for the movie. And Jeff Romaine brought over, like, I guess the kind of first cut.
Yeah.
Right? And we watched it, and I just, both of us were sitting there like
this.
We're
sitting next to each other.
In the movie theater at my house, and I was like, this is fucking crazy. I don't know, when you watch your life go by, or 30-something years of your life go by in 2 hours, I feel like, you know, I saw, but I missed so many elements. And it was so nice last night to see, like, the whole thing. So I've now seen it twice, and I'm probably going to watch it again on
Friday. Will you watch it Friday? The day of post? Like, we were talking about people are having viewing parties, and Douglas has a big party. He's not inviting anybody
in his
too,
house.
But he's got a whole thing going on at his house.
What time?
It was my friend's bar in East London, so
Ewan's like,
that's okay.
It's okay.
We got airplanes.
We got jets. We can all go in on
dust
a jet.
And some jets.
Yeah. We got jets and jets and jets.
Let's do that. That sounds great.
So good to see you.
So Tommy, these guys, of course, you know, played Nikki and played Mick. The guy that plays you in the movie, Colson Baker, a.k.a. Machine Gun Kelly, is, I met him last night at the whiskey, at the after party. It's insane how much he kind of, doesn't necessarily resemble you, but his whole vibe is so you. Did you work with him? Did you hang with him? What was that like for you?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I gave him both meth. So I'm going to take credit for that. Because they're both like geeking out all the time.
Always.
Always, yeah.
The same build, skinny, lanky, fucking psycho. He's fucking crazy, right?
You are basically the same person. I remember. I flew to LA, and that's when I met you for the first time. And we read. I read with three different Tommy Lees. We kind of testing them, and he came in, and as soon as he walked in, we were like, everyone turned to each other, was like, this is the guy. It has to be. He was like, dude, I just crashed my car on the way here, man. I'm like,
Tommy, you're in. You
know what's crazy?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is like all of their dedication to playing each guy, from Colson to all the boys. Like, it's fucking crazy that they like studied, obviously, our mannerisms, the way we walk, the way we talk, the way we. It's fucking crazy it's surreal. It's fucking weird sitting next to you guys.
I mean, can you tell us how you guys, as actors, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's so much footage of you guys for like mannerisms and things, but then also you have to think like, what was Nikki like in public? What was Nikki like in private? Like, what was, you know, so you have to kind of, you can't base your character just on like an MTV interview, of course. So obviously you have the book, The Dirt, and The Heroin Diaries, which for me was one of the biggest insights. It was like minute by minute what you were going through at a certain point in your life. But yeah, it's kind of like watching videos and picking up mannerisms.
How do you change your accent?
Really like go Nikki, like
fuck yeah, dude.
I was like that. Yeah.
Listen to this. He was at my house, a few weeks ago, I don't know, it might have been 3 weeks ago.
A couple of weeks, the week.
And so
weeks,
I was leaving to go to London, right? And I said, I'm going to go, nothing worse than, you know, somebody, an American trying to do a British accent, especially if you ask a Brit. It's like, but of course, as soon as we go there, we start talking, trying that. Hello, love.
Hello, mate.
Yeah, and all that. And they're like, don't do that. So I said that, and then Douglas said, well, I'm just going to become Nikki. And he started talking to me as me. Wow. That was weird, dude. Don't do that again.
Don't do that again.
That was weird.
So just to embellish on the dedication from all these guys, it was fucking insane. Like, Colson came to my house.
Yeah, when did you first meet him?
I've known him for...
Were you a fan of his music? Because you like that kind of music, I know, too, that he makes. Yeah.
I've known him for a couple of years. We did a show together, like, Jesus, like 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was so... He's like, dude, I got to come over to the house right now. he comes over with the script, and he's like, did this go down like that? I was like, yeah, that's pretty much real. Did this go down like that? I was like, yeah, but maybe just a little. He wanted to know every single fucking detail, which was so cool, you know. And then taking drum lessons for 4 months, you know, before the film.
Did he play at all?
Excuse me?
Did he play drums at all before the film?
I think he played like a little bit.
Yeah.
But he had his buddy teach him for like
four
months.
Is it his brother?
Yeah, his brother.
Yeah.
How about the stick twirling thing? Was
dude,
he was never not twirling.
Yeah, he was
stick.
Constantly like, everywhere,
everywhere,
everywhere. Yeah,
no.
Dedication, my man.
Yeah, but, and it pays off. So I mean, it looks brilliant in the film. He really does.
Fucking crazy.
I can't imagine the energy of Tommy and Coulson in the room at the same time.
Oh, you should have seen that shit last night.
Like I said, man, you haven't left the after party yet, have you, Tommy?
I know. Like, okay, guys, time to go home. You go night-night, you go night-night.
But going back to him, because he's the one guy in of the four guys that play each of you that actually has a music career and that actually was, if I'm not mistaken, actually is known more as a musician than an actor. So did someone see him doing his... you know, Machine Gun Kelly and say, hey, that guy would be a great Tommy Lee, or did he actually just come through casting like everybody else?
He said he... Didn't he say he went to, like, five?
Yeah.
Six auditions.
And I think Jeff just met him and was like, this guy needs to be in the movie. And originally, he wanted him to be Nicky's dealer, I think. Because he didn't... Initially, he was going to be, like, the dealer. Or something. This guy's got such incredible energy. He needs to be in my movie. And he has a Jackass tattoo here. So he was like, he's definitely in the film. And then throughout the process, they just realized he is the perfect Tommy Lee.
Yeah, he was like, I auditioned for this thing six fucking times.
You found the right guy, man. And that is, you found the right people in all four of
They're
the
people. They're
fucking
amazing.
Seriously, man, that is such an important element if you're going to do
Where
a biopic. And the fact that you guys found four people who nailed it so brilliantly is incredible. It really is.
And who's missing is Daniel, who plays Vince.
Right.
Which Nicky and I, we're sitting there, we're like, oh my God, we're watching Vince. At what, like maybe 20-something
years
old?
Well, we were in what they call band camp, and we were there, and we were sitting there in two like little folding chairs, like the lower ones, and the guys were running through their stuff, and Daniel, who plays Vince, was in the front where the singer should be, so he's right here, and there's me and Tommy right there. And Tommy just looks at me and goes, it's Vince. Mind blowing,
fucking insane.
Like all you guys,
everyone. We're like, this is fucking surreal.
The only
we're watching,
the only time
we're watching yourself these 30 four years guys ago. That are literally exactly like us.
Yeah, I don't feel it's like I'm watching crazy. Actors. You know, Val Kilmer did that with Jim Morrison. Like you don't see Val Kilmer.
That's true.
Mind blowing. You guys, took that on.
I'm going to tell you something else, Tommy, that freaked me out the first time I saw the film. Speaking of people acting and resembling somebody, the woman in the film that plays Heather Locklear looks identical to her, man.
It's crazy.
Like, I was like, is that actually her? And that, like, I was tripped out by that. That was crazy, man.
Yeah, it was crazy. Heather was going to come to the premiere, but I think she got spooked. She's like, I don't know. Maybe I'll just stay home.
So watching at home, yeah.
Well, is that, I would imagine, because we talked about this earlier before you got here, Tommy, for all the fun moments in the film and all the craziness and all the laugh out loud stuff that happens in the movie, there's also some heavy moments and some dark moments for everybody. So this is going to be for your friends, your family, your exes, whatever. It's, for some, I think about with Vince, there's some couple scenes in this movie for Vince that are going to be a tough watch, and I imagine are.
It is such a fucking roller coaster.
Yes, yes.
Which is it's beautiful. Any good movie has emotion, right? So you got this, you got that. And what I'm excited about, and I tell people this all the time, yes, it's cool for people our age to watch the movie and get catapulted back into, you know, 1982, right? But for the I don't know, 18, 19-year-olds, whatever, they're going to watch this movie and go, fuck, I missed it.
Exactly.
Like, exactly. You know what I mean? Like,
well, we said that earlier.
Because like, it's not like that now.
Right. We exactly said that earlier before you got here. It's like there's people, you go backstage now and people are juicing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's,
they're like, fuck. Fuck.
There aren't TVs flying out of the London down the street at the hotel anymore.
No one does that.
Oh.
Let's be honest with you. As an experienced TV thrower, flat screens are really boring to throw out of them.
Yeah, no.
Oh, well, you know, the band. Woo! Yeah, the new band. Sorry, I'm going to throw my iPad out.
No, you need the old school big ass.
Yeah, you need the big square ones.
The one that smashes cars.
Is that, take me through that a little bit, you guys, because is that almost a rite of passage for a band? When you reach a certain point, like, do you remember the first time you wrecked a hotel room and what the catalyst was to say, I'm going to throw a TV out the window? Like, I'm curious, in the evolution of a band, when does that moment come that say, yeah, I'm going to fucking do this?
I just remember we had these two security guys, Fred Saunders, a guy, Double L, and everyone was on walkie-talkies, so they'd be like, shh, shh, okay, this is going down in room 222. And I just heard, I think Vince, I can't remember, somebody had a gun and was doing target practice. But had a target on the wall in the hotel.
On the wall. All right.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like a 357. Bullseye, good job. So, I mean, just ridiculous. Ridiculous.
But do you
stuff.
Remember your first TV, Nikki? See, before you got here, Tommy, Nikki said he got the ideas and then made you do them. So you'd be the guilty party.
We're a bad team together. Not good.
So, yeah. This is terrible.
Just right now?
Yeah. They would separate us. They would separate. They literally would say we have to separate them. Because as soon as they start talking, some hotel's going to get burnt down.
I just want to give a shout out to our security guards at that point. I fucking love you. I'm sorry. No, we were fucking idiots. Like, fucking idiots. Like, these guys are fucking making tons of money, selling out fucking arenas everywhere, and we're like, what can we do next?
Yeah. Because you know? the more bad we did, the more good that happened, the more tickets sold, the more albums sold. It was so weird for us. I don't know if you've ever heard this story. Me and Tommy Motley was on tour.
What
with,
story is this?
This is the Dio Hotel. Germany.
Got it.
German police, machine guns, Rottweilers. That story?
Rottweilers.
Okay. So
please do tell.
We were on tour. It was, I forget who we were, but it was like one of those big European festivals, I think. I know Ozzy was on the tour because Ozzy was in the lobby and he was getting everybody drunk. And if you passed out, Ozzy would shave your eyebrow off. But there was a lot of people walking around with one eyebrow. So we were always very aware of that could happen to us. And we were all down, and Dio was on tour, and I can't remember who else. But we somehow got the keyboard player from Dio's room key.
Claude Schnell.
We went up to his room, threw all of his furniture out of the German hotel, TVs, beds, the whole thing. Went back, locked the door, went back down and put his room key next to him and went up and continued on. Next thing you know, sirens, cops, machine guns, Rottweilers. They arrest him. And Dio had to cancel his show the next day, but we never told anybody. Because guess what happened?
Sneaky.
We moved up the bill.
Did you got in the film, you actually drop stuff from a hotel room onto a car with the, did that actually happen? Did you actually hit a car down below and drop stuff on a
vehicle? That time we did hit the car.
Always.
Always. It was a goal to hit the car.
You got to have a target, right?
I guess.
It'd be pointless just to throw a TV out the window.
And there's a
there's a fucking Mercedes killer.
And there's a great montage in the film, Tommy, of you. Do you want here's a day in the life on the road where it's in about, I don't know, 60 seconds where you start your day and end your day handcuffed to a bed. And not for fun reasons, by the way. You might think of that as like, oh, you know, getting kinky, but you were literally cuffed to so that you would not inflict any more damage, I assume.
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. I remember once he got handcuffed, and I was like, oh, that's too bad. More alcohol for me. So I went to the bar, and next thing you know, Tommy showed up with a handcuff. He somehow got out of the handcuff.
Yeah!
Yeah. He was all proud.
And I saw him and talked to him last night. Your manager, Doc McGee, at the time, is featured in the movie by a great actor. I think he's... Dave Constabile, I believe is how you say his name. He's in the Showtime show Billions right now. He's a great character in that as well. But the real Doc was at the premiere last night, and I was talking to him a little bit. And when you watch this movie, it's like, my goodness, a guy that needs to be apologized to is Doc McGee.
Dude, that guy has been through way too much. Poor guy. Like, I love him. Dude, we put him through hell.
For sure.
Absolute hell.
When I saw him walking out of the lobby after the film, it looked like he was having some post-traumatic stress disorder
for sure.
Or something.
He was like, somebody just kill me. Just kill me.
We went through this biting phase, and the key target, because targets are very important, as you can tell from me and Tommy.
Right.
The target was the inner thigh. And, man, I had Doc on the couch of the bus. Tommy was pulling a leg open, and I was like trying to get in there, and Doc just punching me in the top of my head. And afterwards, we would all laugh because we were having fun. You know, we weren't really being mean. We were just seeing how far we could take it.
We went through this crazy biting phase where we fucking just would bite you,
draw blood,
and that only meant we loved you.
Uh-huh.
But everyone's like, "Ow." Fuck, what the fuck are you doing?
We would bite the press. We would bite the press.
Bite the press?
Yeah, all the time.
People interviewing you.
Yeah, just we'd be doing like some weird interview in the middle of a festival.
Tommy is now biting Douglas.
He's biting Douglas.
Trying to get through his leather jacket.
Vince bit Eddie Van Halen's hand, and we almost got thrown off the tour.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I said, that's not the target.
No, dude.
Not Eddie's hand. That's not a target.
Remember Malcolm?
Yes.
Malcolm Young?
Yes.
From AC/DC.
You bit Malcolm. You bit the...
Bit the fuck out of him. And he was just like, fucking mate, you fucking fucking idiots.
Holy shit.
Fucking idiots. We were like, dude,
we love you.
We love you.
We love AC/DC.
This is like a kiss.
But what I think is amazing is you saved your biting for like true legends like Malcolm Young, Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah. Of
course. Like, it wasn't the opening acts you're biting. You're biting you're going to leave the mark. It's going to be on a real deal guy. That's pretty
incredible. I remember Doc came to us and he goes, good job, assholes. I think you're getting thrown off the Van Halen tour. We're like, why?
Why?
And then we had to stay in our trailer.
Good job, assholes.
We weren't allowed to leave our trailer when Van Halen was walking to the stage. Yep. Like, it really, literally, like, we were being...
They handcuffed Tommy again.
Yeah.
They're like, nope, stay in there. Get out of here.
I do want to ask about the scene with... I don't know who the actor is who plays Ozzy, but my gosh, is that the scene of scenes? And, look, everybody who's read the book knows the story of snorting the live ants and then the whole piss and all that. What I always wondered about is in... First of all, did you guys talk to Ozzy before you recreated that scene? Did you have to? Did you? Because I would always be one.
That would be on Netflix and Jeff Tremaine. That's the kind of stuff we have to stay out of. Can't really like call Sharon up and go, "Hey, Sharon," you know.
Right.
We just left that to them. So I'm sure everything was worked out.
Hey, Sharon, can we show your husband licking up Nikki's piss? All right.
Well, somebody said all right because it's there, but and it is an incredible. Just when you think Motley Crue couldn't be more insane, here comes Ozzy just raising the bar to a whole nother level.
You have no idea what we know.
Stuff beyond that, Nikki?
The stuff we can't even tell you. everybody, you guys would just turn into dust. The stuff that Ozzy's done with us. Yeah. I mean, we can't tell you. We can't. It would be a career killing for all of us. The worst.
It involves drugs, poop.
Yeah, poop.
Piss.
Blow up dolls.
Ants.
Cars.
I did
swimming
hear,
pools
now
together.
You guys didn't tell me this, but I.
Tidy Whiteys.
I did hear from.
Yes, I do.
He came out in a fucking Nazi, yeah. like Hitler mustache.
That was the blow up, doll.
And he was crying. He was like.
We never knew if Ozzy was like messing with us. It was like we weren't sure if he was our sensei, our psychologist, or Satan. Like you never knew. And yet at the same time, he'd be the sweetest guy ever. Remember we were doing some shows together, and he came on our bus. He was in a dress. He had a blow-up doll and about an ounce of cocaine. And
I'm riding with you guys tonight.
Yeah, he says riding, but first,
we're like, all right.
And then his guy, his assistant guy that was always with him, said, "No, Ozzy, first we have to do a show."
Tony,
we have to do a show. So they put Ozzy in the golf cart, take him up on stage. We're sitting there in the bus, and we hear his intro starting. And then what I love about Ozzy's intros is the music stops, and then he runs on stage, and he goes, "Everybody get crazy," or whatever he says, and then the show starts, right? He walks out, he goes, "Everybody get crazy," and he's in a dress and pulls up his dress, and he's got these tidy whiteys on, and the like crowd, that. And he's got a gray old woman's wig on, and, you know, we would be like, well, if he can do that, we can do that. You know, we would always be, well, we got to top that.
Did you guys ever hear
always.
The effect of snorting live ants into your lungs and I
brought some for you.
No, yes. Thank you. Yes. No, thanks.
Tommy has a straw.
No, thanks. But I can't even imagine like that. Like after that happened, he was seemingly okay. Like singing, drawing breath with live insects in his lungs.
Dude,
we don't know.
Let me just tell you something. For some reason that day, I don't know why, but somebody made me responsible for him. I was like,
"Oh my god!"
No,
oh my god!
No, the tour manager was like, "I can't fucking deal with him. Fuck him. Here's his room key.
Yep.
Fuck off." And I was like,
Tubby's like, "I'm the youngest member of the band, and I'm Ozzy's tour manager now,
and I'm out of handcuffs for the moment.
Yeah, I'm out of handcuffs.
Yeah, and okay, mind you, we're at like the Four Seasons, like some 4 or 5 star resort. Everyone's, you know." It's one of those places where this is all not cool. Like, not
like
cool.
Like, it's cool anywhere.
Right?
So just even having a tattoo at that pool
so
was not cool.
After licking up Nikki's pee, snorting ants, all the shit, I'm like, "Ozzy, let's go to bed. Time to go night-night." He's like, "All right, mate." So we get into the elevator, and he's... pulls his pants down and starts to take a shit in the fucking elevator. I'm like, "No, dude, no. There's people in here." Right? She's like, "Okay, Matt. All right." And he pulls his fucking pants up, and we get to the floor, ding. All right. I'm like, "Okay, here we go. Here's your room, buddy." I open the door, push him the fuck into his room, and he's like, "No. You're not going anywhere, mate." I was like, "What?" And he just fucking pulls his pants down again and shits on the floor and starts taking it and, like, making art
on
the fucking walls. And yeah. I'm like, "Dude, I'm leaving. Good night. See ya." And I try to go, and he's like, "No." I was like, "No, dude, I'm leaving. I'm done. No."
He scared you. Is what you're
dude,
saying.
Ozzy always scared
dude,
us.
Dude, I ran the fuck
we love
out
him,
of
though.
There. Dude.
You know, we have to say, I mean, Ozzy, as crazy and wild and fun as
we
it
love
was,
him.
Him and Sharon gave this band a career.
Yeah.
They took us on the road for 18 months. When we left.
Well, I saw you guys on that tour. Because there was a third band that opened. I think it was Wasted.
It was
wasn't
Wasted.
It?
No, I was stoked.
Pete Way
is one of my guys.
Right,
man.
Me too, yeah.
And then I found him drinking NyQuil.
Why NyQuil?
I don't know, because he was trying to be sober, so he was like had gallons of NyQuil. I'm like, wow, okay.
Well, there's alcohol in that, so that's probably the idea.
It's pretty good. I drank some with him.
That was really a fucking beautiful time.
A great time.
For us, we got to play in front of 18, 20,000 people every single night, and we were just coming up.
Yeah.
No one knew who the fuck we were. We're coming up. And we got to play in front of 20,000 people every single night. And
we were with great people. Ozzy
has a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
Big time. Because, as you know, we went out on the first tour with him, and then, you know, usually bands move on, right? They got another support act. Ozzy just kept taking us. Festivals, they would be like, we want the band on the festivals. They had so much to do with us having, you know, a big career. And that's why it was important for us to put him in the, you know, obviously the story is in the book, but we wanted him in the movie because we wanted to show, like, he's like sort of, it's like, he's like our, you know, role model.
I think he enjoyed so much probably having Tommy as a minder.
That's a big word.
I know, it's a big role word. Role model.
This movie is going to come out on Friday. I have no doubt that this is going to be immensely popular with your fans, and everyone is very excited and amped up about what's going on with Motley Crue, just seeing the guys together, seeing the four of you at the premiere, what have you. I know you made the contract, the final show, we're not playing anymore. The success of this movie, is there any chance that it inspires this band to play again?
That's a target. That's a target. We're the target.
Question that's got to be asked. If you know it's going to come up, you know people are going to start thinking about it and talking about it.
Everybody's thinking about it, but we're not.
You're
I
not.
Don't mean that in a negative way. We haven't even just like talked about that at this point.
Yeah, no.
I mean, to be honest with you, it was this movie was so important to us, and this new music was so important to us. Never thought it would happen. You know, me and Tommy have been pretty open about the fact that we, like when the band ended, we weren't even talking. And that was hard because we were best friends.
Why weren't you talking when it ended?
I actually don't. I mean, there's a lot of different things. But to be honest with you, you get some distance. You go, really?
Like spilt milk? Yeah. So you think maybe it's better that you're friends now and you're doing cool things around Motley, but maybe it's better that you don't. As much as the fans love to see you, then you probably maybe it's better you don't go down that road?
I just think... And that was a long tour. We toured for
2 years.
2 years
without coming home. That's a long time. You guys leave your house for 2 years.
Yeah,
I mean it's
leave your house for 2 years.
It will fuck your head up.
Yeah,
and you're like another fucking turkey sandwich. Like every hotel room service. I mean, I know it sounds like you know, like stupid like quality problems, but you're gone. And you're gone.
Yeah.
And it's like the show, you live for the show, but the show only lasts 2 hours.
Yeah. The way you're chewing your cereal is fucking pissing me off.
Yeah.
Like it gets
it's
to,
true.
Like,
it's
it
true.
Gets to dumb shit.
Because it said Motley Crue on the marquee of the whiskey last night, and it just said Motley Crue. And you know how many people came up to me like, dude, they're playing? Are they playing in there? And I was
know.
No, they're just Tommy's up
I'm
there
like,
drinking.
No, we're not playing.
One of my friends, he's so stupid. He lives in Westlake, and he hit me up. He goes, dude, I'm here to see you play. And I go, I'm in bed. He's like, fuck.
You're like,
he drove 2 hours.
Tommy's there. I mean, he might play drums. I don't know.
All right. So
drum solo.
No, nothing imminent on that front. Before we run out of time, the new record.
I just want to say one thing about that.
Please do.
Is that we were not like in the best headspace, and then we were hanging out together on the set, and we just started realizing how much the whole band meant to us, but what our friendship meant to each other, and it was Tommy that said. We've known each other longer than anybody, right? Except for our parents, and our parents have almost all passed away. So you really there's only a handful of people that have known us as long as we've known each other, and that opened the door to talking about music. And then I said I got a couple songs. Like I literally was like, I have a couple songs. Like I didn't even know if I should say it out loud. That kind of sound a little. Motley-like, and he's like, well, what were they for? And I was writing some stuff with John Five, and then Tommy goes, well, I got some kind of cool stuff, and we didn't know if the other guys would be interested. We just kind of started this thing, and we called Bob Rock, and Bob knows how to get us to be the best version and
just get the team back together.
Got the team back together, and these four songs happened. That's on the and the single, the Dirt, is the fastest growing single we've had since Dr. Feelgood.
That's
kind of unbelievable.
Absolutely awesome.
This is a really good story. So we covered Madonna's Like a Virgin, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah. Have you heard it? It's fucking rad, right? Okay, well, it's all this guy's fault.
Oh, wow.
So he's like, Tommy, I have this idea for a cover. And I was like, all right. You know, I'm always open to everything. He's like, I can't tell you what it is.
It's the stupidest phone call. Because it's like saying, hey, guess what? I got you a Christmas present, and it's July. It's yeah, I was...
Yeah, and he's like, I can't tell you what it is. I just have to play it for you. And I was like, okay. So he comes over. We're working on bass and drums for the Dirt record. And he goes, dude, check this out. And he puts a demo on. And I was like, what the fuck?
But at first he was like, because it doesn't sound like Madonna at all.
No, hell no.
And he was going like, oh, this is cool. And it's got that kind of raking rock, big heavy thing in the beginning. Yeah. And then Tommy's like this. And and all of a sudden, I saw his eyes get bigger. And then I'm like, oh, man, he's going to punch me right in my fucking face. I was like getting ready to get up and leave. And that verse started, and you like were like, wow.
I know. And then the chorus drops. I was like, dude, this is fucking insane. Let's rip it.
Yeah.
It was fucking crazy.
And I think it's funny that Vince is singing like a virgin.
Yes. Can you imagine Nikki going like, hey, dude, I got this really rad idea. Want to cover like a virgin?
Then no.
I would be like,
if you would have called
hell
me,
no.
If you would have called me and said, dude, I got this idea like a virgin, I'd go, I don't know.
You'd be like, no,
there's
no,
only
no,
one way
no.
to do it. But then when Bob Rock got us to do it,
right.
Like beyond the demo, it, man.
Yeah. Fuck, it's dope.
Yeah, it's killer. And there's three original songs on there, which is, of course, The Dirt, which is the entitled after the movie. Before we run out of time, there's one other guest that we need to bring up here before we wrap up.
Oh, no.
And he is also prominently in the film, and he is played by Pete Davidson in the film as well. And he's the guy that signed
Motley
Crue. In the house.
Oh, yeah.
The real Tom Zutow.
Tom Zutow.
Thomas.
You will see Pete Davidson portray him in The Dirt. This is the man that brought the world Motley Crue, ladies and gentlemen, having an embrace with Nikki and Tommy at the moment.
Okay, this guy is responsible for all this shit. It's all your fault, Thomas.
Tom, how did you feel about seeing the movie and seeing how you were portrayed by Pete Davidson in the film?
I actually loved it.
You did?
Yeah, I did. It was a little comedic. I wasn't quite as funny, but I got the Netflix diet. I was the only guy that doesn't look like the real guy, but it was cool.
And the whole experience of we're here in the rainbow. I mean, you actually had a moment here in the rainbow, which you'll see in the film, right?
I'll share a little story, which is, every successful band that I signed was in the back corner left booth.
That's what I just said, right?
So, yeah, exactly. And you know, all the bands that I took to other booths failed. Like GNR was in that booth. Dokken was in that booth. And you know, it's funny, in the movie, I don't know if people caught it, but Motley Crue was opening for Dokken, and that made me chuckle.
I did see that. Yeah.
Wait, Thomas, do you remember you, me, Nikki? We went to go see Guns N' Roses, and we're like, dude, you got to sign these fucking guys.
Yeah, I wanted Nikki to produce them. I begged him.
This is one of those things where I
no
go,
one knew who
wow.
the fuck they were.
He came to me and asked me to produce them, and I liked them. Slash was hanging out at my house all the time. And you also asked me to write a song for that movie, Out of Bounds.
Yes.
And that... I started writing that song, and then it turned into Nona, which is on Girls, Girls, Girls album, when my grandmother passed away and just kind of banished it. But I was so I was strung out at the time, and I passed on GNR because I think I would have blown it.
I even said to Nikki, I said, look, you know, Paul and Gene want to produce the band, but I want you to do it.
Yeah. But well, thank you for that opportunity.
You know? Yeah.
But I talked to Mike Klink years later when he produced a Motley Crue album, and I said, everybody knows that story, and I said, what was it like in the studio? And he said, I basically just pushed play. I just pushed record.
We called it capturing lightning.
It was capturing lightning in a bottle, yeah. And that's how our first album was too. It was like live off the floor. There it is.
And I want to say the new music, guys, is like it gives me excitement, like in the real early days. And just another thing about the movie, you know, the movie is a great story, and it's sort of like what I envisioned when I actually met you guys and signed you, that this movie would be how it really happened. Mm. And it's kind of cool to see the movie do that.
Is there anything in the movie, you know, a lot of times when these movies are made, no matter how great they are, there's what they call Hollywood taking liberties, like maybe changing a storyline or embellishing something that wasn't there. Is there anything in this movie that while you watch it, you were, you know, maybe that's just a slightly not the way it went down, that they kind of ran with a little for the, because these aren't documentaries. So they, you know, they do like to build out the storyline a little. There's plenty of meat on the bone with the book as it is, but is there anything that when you watched it and you look back and you're like, well, that kind of is maybe a little bit of a turn from where it really was? Anybody, anything in there?
Well, I mean, what I learned was we had two managers. We had Doc McGee and Doug Thaler, and we at one point had two security guys, Fred Saunder and Fran Saunders and Double L, and we had a tour manager named Rich Fisher. In the movie, there's really only Doc McGee. And I remember talking to Jeff about that. He said, there's not another 15 minutes in the film to describe two managers, two security guys, and a road manager. So it all became one guy, which was better for storytelling.
But you referenced Doug Thaler. It's actually funny what you do, because I think, I don't know who says it, but it's like, well, this guy was really important to us too. But there's not enough time for him, and he literally evaporates
on the
screen.
And that's being honest, right?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I could tell you about one event, and I think it's apropos because of where we're sitting, which is the only reason that I got in to the sold-out show at the Whiskey is because of Mario, right? And, you know,
who owns
the Rainbow,
right.
and the Whiskey. Whiskey, yeah. Right. So I couldn't get in, right? So they said, you have to talk to the owner. So I talked to Mario, and he was like, give me your business card. He looked at it. It said marketing and sales. He goes, it doesn't say A&R. And I said, look, Mario. And I was like 19 years old. I was a kid, really. I said, I am going to find the biggest rock and roll bands in the fucking world in your club, and your club is going to be famous again like it was in the 60s. Just let me in. And he's like, kid, where are you from? And I said, Chicago. He goes, I'm from Chicago.
Oh,
he said, do you know anybody? And I said, I gave a certain name of somebody, and he's like, come on in. So if Mario hadn't let me in, I would have never found these guys. Yeah. So it's just those little things sometimes connect and amazing things
happen. I love
happen.
That stuff.
And yeah. Tom, how much pressure were you getting from the label? Like when things are unraveling with Motley, which is shown in the movie as well, you're the point guy. You're in the trenches with them. You're trying to stay away from, you know, becoming a drug addict or whatever's going on in their world. But you also have to answer to your bosses. And, you know, there's scenes in the movie, get them back on the road. A lot of pressure for you.
I always fought for the bands, right? And one of the reasons I don't work for a major label anymore is there came a time where I was fighting for bands, and the CEO of the company called me in and said, you know, you're not a company guy. And I said, I can't be a company guy, because if you're doing what's right for the artist, then you're going to sell lots of music and make lots of money. So being a company guy, it does a disservice to trying to make successful music, and he fired me.
And that's very true what you said. And then and record companies and a lot of businesses work on quarterly billing. And when Motley Crue got our masters, we don't have to answer to anybody. We answer to what's the next right creative thing to do. with our music, whatever it is to do. And that's what Tom's saying, is he got fired because that's how he thinks.
Yeah,
and that's how you have to think if you want to be an independent artist.
And here we are sitting with one of the few bands that got their masters back.
Yeah. And which is
incredible.
Which is also seen in the film, which is an important sort of pivotal moment in you guys kind of taking the rights back to your world and sort of retooling and starting over again almost, which you had to do at that point.
Can I just say something that's very weird to me?
We got 60 seconds.
What is this? It's a CD.
That is still my favorite format for music. Thank you, Tom.
The best.
Long live the CD. The best still.
I might
absolutely
have to steal it.
I'm with you all the way. Well, thanks to Ewan Rayan and Douglas Booth, two of the actors from The Dirt. Thanks to Nikki Six and Tommy Lee, two of the members of Motley Crue. Thanks to their A&R guy back in the day, Tom Zutout, for dropping by there at the end. Look forward to doing something way more substantial with Tom with all his stories somewhere down the line. Thanks to everybody who came out to the Rainbow a couple weeks ago to be a part of that special with Motley Crue. And, of course, thanks to the Rainbow Bar and Grill for hosting the Trunk Nation's L.A. Invasions. As I was saying earlier, the next one is really, really coming up soon, like in a week or so. So please be sure to keep an eye on eddietrunk.com and my social media. I'll let you know as soon as it's locked who the guests are going to be. If you're in Southern California, come down. Everybody else, listen live on Sirius XM 106 volume. You can hear me there every day talking rock with you, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, or you can listen to the show on demand anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. If you're in the U.S. and Canada and are already not a Sirius XM subscriber, please come on board and join us. You will not regret it. We have a great time talking rock every day. And if you can't listen in either of the two broadcast windows every day, like I said, on the app, you get the show that day on demand and listen anytime you want. And hope you join us, all the members of Trunk Nation that gather every day to talk nothing but rock on volume. Thanks to Katie Irizarry. She is the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast. And I will see you guys again next Thursday for another all new episode. Have a good week.
Keeping up with the Kardashians?
I would not be surprised if Kylie Jenner hires a private investigator to follow Travis Scott around and make sure he's not cheating.
Join blogger and king of snark, Perez Hilton, to keep track of their latest family drama, as well as everything else happening in the celebrity world.
She also said, "I am not clickbait," and that's what I disagree with. Because she is clickbait.
Download new episodes of the Perez Hilton podcast every Monday on Podcast One.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.